This is Holding Court with Patrick McEnroe.
All right, Patrick McEnroe here. Welcome to another Tuesday tennis edition of Holding Court. And I'm very lucky today to be joined by Mr. Sam Gore. Works with me at ESPN for many, many years, covering not just tennis, by the way. We're going to have to get into all those different sports you cover, Sam. I know volleyball, softball, basketball. First of all, you're here because I've always wanted to have you on, and I thought this was a perfect time because you just covered the NCAA tournament down there in Orlando where you live. Thanks for coming on. Did I get all the sports right? What did I miss?
Those are the majority of the ones that I regularly do. Every once in a while, I'll do an NCAA gymnastics meet.
Right.
And an NCAA beach volleyball. But you got most of them right.
So where does tennis stack up for you? Before we get into the NCAA tournament, which you covered, just generally speaking, what's your favorite? I know you have to say tennis because you're talking to me, but go. Let me hear.
No, I don't. Honestly, Patrick, I mean, tennis is the sport that I most closely identify personally with. I mean, I grew up in North Carolina. I started playing when I was around 8 years old. I played juniors. I even competed in USTA adult tournaments until my broadcasting career really kind of took me away from competing. So tennis is the one sport I played at a decent level. And so I've just never lost that feeling of, you know, walking into a room and looking around and seeing you and John and Chrissy and MJ and BG and I'm right. Like, who doesn't belong in this room? But all of a sudden I do. And so it's the one sport that I'm a fan of year round, in addition to getting to work. And the college sports really have kind of taken over the majority of my schedule. But because of that, I get to do college tennis, which is almost like a whole other game, but now becoming this great pathway to the pros. And so it's just been really neat how tennis has come full circle to now college tennis being a really legitimate thing.
I have to tell you, we're going to get into the college because there's a great article out today in the New York Times too about college tennis just in general, you know, surrounding obviously the final weekend, which you covered. But I got to give you major props, okay? Because, I mean, I don't need to tell you this, but I need to tell everybody listening that to get into the broadcasting world of tennis is almost impossible if you weren't an ex-high-level player. So, you know, the fact that you've worked your way to where you're part of our team at ESPN, you host, you do the play-by-play, you do tons of ATP events as well. That must have been hard for you, number one, just to be able to stay the course and make that happen. And I guess my other question is, how did you make that happen?
Well, I mean, the simple answer would be divine intervention, because I can't really go back and explain how it happened. But I think it gets back to, when you're really passionate about something, it doesn't feel like work. And so you just naturally, therefore, I think, work harder to get where you want to be. And I was always so passionate about tennis, and I was very fortunate to have people that lived around me, like Bob Rosberg and Cliff Drysdale, when Cliffy was in Wilmington, North Carolina, where I used to live. And they saw me not only as a decent tennis player at our local club, but also someone that was in broadcasting and passionate about the sport. So I was pretty much in the right place at the right time to start doing tennis on air. But it is the one sport, and I tell people this all the time, because I'll have friends at ESPN, other play-by-plays come up and say, oh, I want to get into tennis. And I say, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, right.
Because if you're not a sport of tennis, I mean, if you're not a huge fan of tennis, and you're not a former player like myself, it is the worst sport to be involved in television, with those exceptions. Because, like, for example, when I'm doing a college basketball game, I pretty much know what time I'm showing up and what time I'm leaving.
Mm-hmm. Right.
When I do tennis, I know what time I'm required to be there, but I have no idea when it's going to be over. And so for me, I never even look at my watch, because I love the sport so much. I love the players, the personalities, the stories. But if you don't love tennis and you're not a former player, getting into it in terms of, from my side as a host and a play-by-play, it can be very, very challenging. So I just had a lot of people, Patrick, that I happened to come across that helped put me in a position to get where I am. I mean, from Bob Rosberg and Cliff Drysdale to Brian Williams and, you know, now Jamie Reynolds that is our boss at ESPN. For some reason, I didn't annoy them enough that they just kept putting me in positions.
Oh, you're just damn good. You're damn good. And by the way, you know what I get all the time, right? When you're on the air.
Oh, yeah, we sound alike, yeah.
We sound similar. So one of my buddies who I coached a bit, who was on the team at Duke, he and I were texting, and they lost to Virginia, I think, in the round of 16. They also lost them in the ACC final. So anyway, we were just texting, and I was saying, who do you like? Who do you think's going to win it? And we got down to the final eight. And he says, hey, I heard you calling the women's final last night. I said, no, that wasn't me. That must have been Sam. And that's where it hit me. So I got to get Sam on to come on and talk about.
It's funny because I don't think you and I sound alike when we're just talking. But for some reason, when I get on the air, our inflection and our voices seem to sound alike. Even, I mean, I've had my own family members say, hey, was that you or Patrick? I'm like, what are you doing?
Interesting.
It?
Yeah. It's like me and my brother. I get that with my brother. They have to change all the levels in the production truck.
Hey, before we go any further, I got to give you a little crap about something. Because
okay, go ahead.
I've been listening to I always listen to your podcast. You and Renee, you know, you're like my brother and sister in tennis. So I like to keep tabs on what you guys are doing and talking about. And I thought when you had Peter Botto on, you were a little casual about Cincinnati moving. Mm-hmm.
Because I'm glad to have you on actually about that, because I don't know about it. Okay,
I don't know if it's moving or not, but let me tell you why I laughed. I have never seen any human being eat as much Grater's ice cream in one week than you when we would do Cincinnati. I mean, you had staff on red alert. I mean, when we would come in, someone was designated to go get Patrick McEnroe's ice cream that day. So for you,
that's so funny you mentioned that, because just last week I was driving one of my daughters. And I can't remember how, but because, you know, I am an ice cream fanatic, although I'm trying to get, you know, Sam, by the way, is fit as a fiddle. And we laugh about him. You know, he's eating all the power bars and he's got all the energy drinks, and he gets up at 5 a.m. to work out. So all us, you know, ex-professional athletes, we got the little gut, you know, Sam's ripped. Okay. So we admire that very much. So I'm sitting with my daughter. And we started talking about ice cream. And I said, what's your favorite flavor? And she said, oh, I love, it's like the black cherry with the chocolate chips in it, which is like a Grater specialty. And it reminded me, Sam, you're going to appreciate this. When I got COVID, I was right here in my basement where I do the podcast. When I first got COVID, which was right in the beginning of the whole pandemic, March of 2020, nobody knew anything. I ended up being in my basement for like a month. They sent me a package Grater's ice cream.
No way.
They sent me like 4 or 5 flavors. It was unbelievable. Yeah.
I'm sure you were great for their bottom line when we were there. Not only
I think their bottom line is doing just fine. But anyway, let's get into that, because that's an interesting topic. You're a North Carolina guy. I mean, you just moved to Florida a few years back. But like you said, playing tennis there, it's a great part of the country for tennis.
Yeah.
Obviously, Cincinnati, the history there of the tournament's phenomenal up until the time that ESPN went there. Lost the rights to it a couple of years ago. I was there every year, loved going there, loved the fans, loved the whole vibe. Could that actually happen? I'm just finding, you know, he caught me by surprise, Peter, with that question, because I don't really know that much about it. Todd Martin, who, of course, I've taken over with Dan Faber at the Hall of Fame, trying to fill his big shoes. The two of us are there. I'm with the Hall of Fame now as the president. Todd left to run the Charleston tournament. What's the name of the guy who owns the tournament and he owns now Cincinnati?
I'm not sure.
You know his name?
Yeah, I can't.
All right. Well, anyway, he's a very wealthy guy who owns the Charleston tournament and then has just recently purchased the rights to the tournament in Cincinnati. And he's from the Carolinas. So I think that's where this story is coming from. Tell me anything else that you know, because that's really all I know about it.
Again, it was I was just laughing at Grater's ice cream. I don't know the whole story behind it. I get things, admittedly, from a North Carolina perspective, And I know that this facility they're building in Charlotte is built with the intent to host a Masters 1000 level event. So I don't know the politics behind whether they would move Cincinnati. Clearly you and Peter fleshed that out pretty comprehensively, but it would be huge for Charlotte. It would make a lot of sense just in terms of the geographic location and ease of travel in and out of Charlotte. And then the weather just before the U.S. Open in Charlotte is, you know, pretty much a great preparation for going to New York. So, and they have that ATP 250 event in Winston-Salem.
Right.
So it would be, that would bend, you know, that would bump up that event as well. So, North Carolina is hoping it goes there, but I don't know in terms of the politics, the logistics of it. So,
we'll continue to follow that story. All right, let's get into the NCAA.
Right.
So let's start with the women, because that was the first final that you covered. Speaking of North Carolina, was between UNC. There you go. You got your heels on. And the Wolfpack from NC State, which sort of, as far as I can see, came out of nowhere. I know they got the top player in the country. And is it Schneider? You pronounce
Schneider,
her last name?
Deanna? She's pronounced Schneider. Yeah. Schneider.
Right. So she played number one. She, of course, I mean, we first saw her at the Australian Open where she almost beat, I think it was Sakari.
Yep, it was. In the second round.
In the second round. And I'm like, this girl's going to college? Wow, yeah. She's a player. So tell me about how that unfolded. And it seemed like UNC, they lost at the number one spot, that they seemed to win most of the other matches. Was it comfortable, or how tight were the matches?
Matches were tight. The interesting thing about North Carolina women is that they've been the top team in the country for the majority of the past 5 years or so. And they win the indoor title every year. I think they've won four straight indoors. But they always seem to get upset at the NCAAs. And so this year they came in again as the number one seed. The only team that's beaten them the entire year was North Carolina State. And that was with this same team that they played in Lake Nona at the USTA and the NCAAs.
Where was that match that NC State beat them? Was that outdoors?
Yes, it was outdoors. It was in the finals of the ACC Championship in Cary, North Carolina. So it was recent.
Which is another great facility. Yeah.
And so basically, it was the first time these two same teams had played since that ACC Championship. And Diana Schneider, she is their number one player. She's Russian. And she made a very smart decision, because she realized, even with the opportunity she had, a top 100 ranking, third, you know, reaching as far as she did in the Australian Open, that traveling the world as a Russian tennis player when you're not established all of a sudden is going to be pretty difficult to do, at least at that time. Things are improving a little bit for them. But she decided to come to North Carolina State and play. She's playing in the individual championships this week, and then she's going straight to Paris. So she's kind of using the NCAAs as a training block to get ready for the French Open, and she'll leave here from Paris. But North Carolina, getting back to the Tar Heels, their number one player is actually the eighth ranked player in the country, Reese Brantmeyer. She was one of our top juniors. This is her freshman year. She played number one, and Fiona Crawley, who is ranked number one in the nation in singles, plays two for North Carolina.
Wait a second. Hold on. Let me stop you there.
Yeah.
So the girl who plays number one is ranked number eight in the country.
Yep.
And the girl who plays the woman who plays number two for North Carolina, Crawley, is ranked number one in the country.
Exactly.
Right? So what am I missing here?
Well, it's funny because
I know, but I just want to hear you explain it.
Well, like, when they set these lineups, coaches can challenge, and no one challenged that. There's not a lot of difference between Brantmeyer and Crawley. College rankings are fairly complex compared to like your tour rankings. So just because someone's ranked number one doesn't mean they're going to have to play number one every week
on the team.
Right.
Particularly when they're that close. I'm going to look up their UTR while you're talking. So
yeah.
Go ahead.
So anyway, Reese Brantmeyer lost at one, and then the Tar Heels pretty much won everything else. The doubles point was crucial for them. Because that doubles in college tennis, you play first, you play 3 one-set matches. Whoever wins two of those courts takes the doubles point. And right. NC State had taken the doubles point the last time they played. So North Carolina went into the singles with a little bit of momentum. And I think that this North Carolina team was just determined to get it done. They came out way more aggressive than I've ever seen them play before. And it paid off. They came away with their first national title.
Amazing. All right, so just for the record, Fiona Crawley, I'm looking at the UTR now because you can go to each college and see the whole roster. She's ahead of Brantmeyer, 11.35. Brantmeyer is 11.14. And for those of you who don't know about the UTR, it's called the Universal Tennis Rating. It rates every player on the planet, from the top pro in the world to you and me, if we play any competitive tournament, even if we just play like a USTA tournament. So that's pretty close.
Yeah.
The UTR between those two, but Crawley, interestingly, is higher, and I believe she's the one seed, or is Schneider the one seed in the tournament?
The interesting thing about that is Crawley's the number one seed. Schneider is not even one of the top four seeds.
Is that because she hasn't played as many matches?
Yeah, she didn't join the team until after Australia, and so
she didn't have a full season.
She's the number seven seed, but. Most people obviously believe she's
her UTR is way higher than both of them, by the way. It's 11.94, which is close to, you know, most professional women players, like in the 50 to 100 in the world, I'm going to say, are about usually a 12 and a half UTR. That the top players in women's tennis would just be over 13
right.
UTR. You know, it's a 13.22. I think that's where Swiatek, Sabalenka, right at that level. So that's a pretty big difference. Pretty big difference. But big for UNC. As you said, they've been knocking on the door for so long. So it was good to see them get one of our players at our McEnroe Tennis Academy. Theodora Rabman is going there next year. She's one of the top juniors in the world. So she'll go in to UNC next year. She's over in Europe right now playing on the clay. So that's exciting for her and for us at the academy. All right. So the men's side came down. I mean, he had the two teams from Texas, who won it last year. TCU with my man David Roditi, who I say my man because he used to work for me at the USTA, was a doubles player on the tour. He's brought so much energy and positivity to college tennis, just in general with the Frog, whatever the Frog, how they do the Frogs, you know, go Frogs. They were there again. They've been knocking on the door, couldn't get it done. And Virginia wins it again. And, you know, Virginia won it last, I should say Virginia won it last year.
Yeah.
Texas won it 2 years ago, right?
Right.
Is that right?
Actually, Texas won 3 years. 19.
Oh, because it was Florida.
Florida won in 21.
Florida with Ben Shelton. It was funny. I was reading the New York Times article because it came out in today's paper, but it was online over the weekend. And as I was reading it, I was thinking about what was going on in Orlando with you covering the college tennis. And I turn on Tennis Channel to see what, you know, if the match was on, the college match. And there's Ben Shelton playing in Geneva, right, in front of like 50 people. And I'm thinking to myself, I wonder where Ben Shelton wishes he were back, you know, in Orlando, still playing for Florida, because if he were still there, they might be in the championship match. But that's kind of the whole thing. Let's talk about the matches themselves first,
okay,
and then just the bigger picture of college tennis. Yeah. UVA, I mean, they dominated the last couple of matches, and they were a team. They'd lost to Ohio State a couple of times this year, and they smoked them in the championship match.
They had, but they had lost indoors, so it was the first time they played them outdoors. But it was interesting the way the men's tournament played out, because most people felt like this year Texas and TCU were the top two teams, and they were the top two seeds. And especially this was just a blazing hot week in Orlando. Hot, humid, storms. In fact, it impacted the men's tournament. Originally, the men were supposed to play their quarters, semis, and final at night. And because of a washout on the night they were supposed to play their quarters, it shifted everything by a day, and they had to start at noon for their semis and their championship. So at that point, when they went into the semis, people are thinking, this is just going to be a no-brainer. Texas and TCU will win this just by virtue of the conditions. They're used to playing in this heat and humidity. But Virginia and Ohio State did just a masterful job at handling the conditions and were able to beat Texas and TCU to play in the final. And then when you get to the final, that's when it really matters that you've been there before. And Ohio State men are a lot like the North Carolina women. They've been one of the blue blood programs for the majority of every season. But that's the thing Ty Tucker and Ohio State have not gotten is that championship. Right. And so I almost feel like they were feeling a lot more pressure than Virginia, who was not expected to be back there this year. But Coach Pedrosa, he's just done a masterful job at recruiting kids that fit the way he likes to teach and coach. And they're thriving right now. They're the top team in the country. They've won 6 titles in 11 years.
It's a juggernaut. And I remember seeing Coach Pedrosa, who also worked at the USTA, by the way, when I was there as a coach. Great guy. It was a great opportunity for him to go to UVA, and he's done an incredible job. But last year I went over to Paris to do some stuff for our sponsor, BNP, which sponsors our academy. I don't do the commentary now because it's no ESPN. But it had to be like a couple of days, Sam, after the NCAAs ended. And there was Coach Pedrosa scouting the juniors at the French. And I was like, man, I said, don't you go on like vacation? And Joyce goes, no, right back to work. Got to reload. Yeah. And that's exactly what he's been doing. But it's interesting because both Ohio State and you mentioned the outdoor matches versus the indoor, which is an important part of this conversation because people have to understand that when you come from a cooler climate type of school, Ohio State, obviously UVA, okay, gets a little warmer early, but they play most of their tennis throughout the year indoors, you know, and so that makes a difference when you move outdoors. So to your point, Sam, Texas and TCU, they're playing their home matches, I think, outdoors all year. Do they have any indoor matches?
They have indoor option, but it's majority of the time.
Predominantly outdoor.
Yeah,
right?
Outdoor, so you would, unless there's weather, and then they'll move indoors. But, yeah.
Interesting. So let's take a little quick break. We come back. Let's get into sort of the bigger picture of college tennis. As you've already made a couple of comments on that. I'm interested to hear more about that. I'll talk a little pros as well as the Italian Open just finishing up. It's Holding Court. Patrick McEnroe, Sam Gore is my guest here on this Tennis Tuesday. North Organic CBD is a new sponsor of Holding Court. I love their CBD gummies. They come in 2 delicious flavors, strawberry lemonade and green apple. I've had them both amazing. 1 a day and you're totally okay. I like to stay active. I like to keep playing tennis. I like to get in the gym. That's why I love North Organic CBD. Their products are made in the USA. They're high quality. They're specially formulated broad spectrum organic CBD products for everyday adventurers. Don't forget about the very popular CBD salve from North Organics. Immediate relief of any physical pain. I use it daily for my sore shoulders, sore knees, hips, you name it. It works wonders. Go to NorthOrganicCBD.com and enter Patrick20, that's Patrick20, for 20% off your order.
The Johnny Mack Tennis Project transforms young lives.
By removing the economic, racial, and social barriers to success through tennis.
JMTP provides tennis as a vehicle for greater life opportunity.
The programming provides a pathway to success through competitive tennis, leading to increased health and fitness, college scholarships, and incredible career opportunities.
JMTP introduces tennis to thousands of underserved New York children every week.
To date, the Johnny Mack Tennis Project has reached over 10,000 students through its community programs, providing 462 individual scholarships, totaling over $8.6 million, and 32 of its scholarship recipients have gone on to receive college scholarships through tennis. For more info, go to jmtpny.org.
I can't wait to hit the court after school.
All right, welcome back to Holding Court. Patrick McEnroe here, joined by Sam Gore, my colleague from ESPN, covers all things college sports, including tennis, including a lot of pro tennis with us as well. Give me the bigger picture, Sam. You mentioned this a couple of times, where college tennis is becoming, because when I went to college at Stanford, I mean, you had this was our top 4 guys: Dan Goldie, Jim Grab, Derek Ristagno, me, all players that eventually, I think all of us became at least top 30 players. Maybe a couple of us, a couple of those guys a little higher, even Ristagno, I think, made top 20. And that was pretty consistent. UCLA, the same, USC. It's now shifted. The power shift has gone to outside of California. I mean, USC, UCLA, Stanford have not been significant factors on the men's side recently. Of course, USC had that great run when they had Stevie Johnson and the rest of them. So it shifted sort of the Midwest to the South, Virginia in there as well. But it's really, and I guess my first, let me first ask you, why do you think that shift has happened?
Well, first of all, I think it comes down to facilities. And in the SEC and the ACC specifically, they place so much emphasis on facilities and training and having, you know, strength and conditioning programs. The SEC and ACC are highly competitive. As you know, we run their television networks, the ACC network and the SEC network. So if you're going to an SEC or an ACC school, you're not only going to get a good education, you're going to have access to some of the top facilities in the world. I mean, they're facilities you could never have access to beginning your professional career. Even if you're coming to train at the USTA National Campus, what a lot of these schools have in the SEC, ACC, and Big Ten, I should throw in there as well,
right,
really surpasses anything that anyone else has ever seen before. And not to diminish what they have in the Pac-12, because obviously they have good facilities as well, but it's still a little bit below what they have with the SEC and the ACC and the Big Ten. It's just athletics really takes center stage. And now with the restrictions being lifted on playing professionally a little bit and some of the prize money you can take and expense, the ATP's just come out with a program at the start of the year where every college player that is ranked in the top 20 or makes the quarterfinals of the individual championships this week will get up to 8 wild cards in challengers.
Wow. This summer. That's a lot.
So now you have a pathway legitimized from college to the pros. There's an actual pathway to do it. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, when you start looking at my career, okay, I'm a really good junior. Should I turn pro? Should I go to college? Now, all of a sudden, the scale is tipped to, I think I could benefit more as a tennis player and as a human being, maturity-wise, going to college than turning pro. And one of the great examples of that on the men's side is Ethan Quinn, who is one of our top juniors. He's the top player at Georgia and a threat to win the men's title this week.
Let me ask you this, and I know the influx of foreign players has played a part in what I think is the growth of college tennis, because I used to get a lot of crap, you know, when I was running the USTA. Don't let college foreign players come in and take all the spots of our kids, meaning our American kids. And, of course, that was a whole nother issue. I was like, yeah, you go up against the NCAA, like, I don't think that's a winning proposition, but, you know, that was one of my arguments. I was like, I can't win this battle, so why fight it? And the other argument I had was, you know what, these players are going to make our players better.
Yeah.
And I think that's been proven out, you know, in the last 5-6 years where you're seeing the American guys playing in college, a lot better athletes, you know, just better players overall. Obviously, Ben Shelton's one of them. This kid, Ethan Quinn, who you mentioned, you know, we'll keep our eye on him to see if he can make the transition. What percentage, Sam, just off the top of your head, I mean, you were like, let's say in the final four teams, what percentage of the singles players in the men's side in the top six of the lines were foreign, would you say? I mean, I know TCU had like 5 or 6, but overall, what's it about, 50-50?
It depends on the school, but in the semifinals of the NCAAs, and I could, you know, I haven't looked, but I would say 50-50.
50-50, yeah.
Yeah, that would be a pretty good guess.
And the women is a little less about the same?
Yeah, a little less with the women, but still, you know, probably 60-40 American is,
right.
I would say, again, North Carolina State had a lot more foreign players than North Carolina, for example.
Right.
It just depends. It's really a school thing, Patrick. Certain schools really pay attention to that more adamantly than others. But tennis is such a global sport, as you know. It really comes down to who's better. So you're not really looking as a college coach at, I need to take this kid because he's an American. You're a coach of a team. You want to win. So if you have two players, one's American and one is not, but the other one who's not American is a way better player and has all the things that you're looking for in terms of character and integrity, you're not discriminating against the American, you're just taking the better player. And a lot of our foreign juniors now are starting to see that it's a pretty good deal to try to go to the United States and play college, whereas before they were more likely to go straight to the tour.
Interesting. And by the way, the UTR, the Universal Tennis Rating, has been a huge factor, because now coaches, college coaches, they can just look up a UTR of players from all over the world. Doesn't matter where they're from, and they have a pretty good idea. And then they dive into, as you said, Sam, you know, their character, what type of style they play. Are they going to fit in with the team at the university? But literally just to be able to look up, hey, this guy's from Sweden, let's check his UTR. You know, right away they have a measuring stick of where he stands. All right, speaking of global, let's get into the professional global side, since I know you covered that. Are you doing anything for the French?
No.
Or because you're out like me at ESPN. All right. Yeah. So Medvedev, huge surprise, winning Rome, at least for me, and had a, you know, had a great run on clay. I still don't put him as one of the favorites to win it. I'd still obviously put Joker and Alcaraz at the top, and then you got Runa, who I think could be real dangerous there. Sinner, you know, Tsitsipas, not the best clay court season for him, but I still think he's more of a threat to win it than Medvedev is on the men's side. What's your take now that Rafael Nadal, you know, just officially announced this past week that he's not playing? Do you, who do you give the edge to going in?
Well, I think it's certainly obviously a no-brainer. It opens the door for a lot of people that would never have had a chance had Rafa been there. The interesting thing about Alcaraz, though, is, you know, everyone is so hyped up on Carlos, and he certainly has legitimized everyone's thoughts on him so far, but I don't think he's played as the favorite enough to really see how he's going to handle that. So now with Rafa out, he's rolling into the French. Everyone's looking at him as the man and not just this cool new guy in the sport that can beat the top guys. I'm interested to see how he handles that dynamic as a favorite, because, you know, Roger and Rafa, they flipped a switch and they were able to carry on as the favorite. They liked being the man. They liked being the guy to beat. Mm, and we haven't seen that enough from Carlos yet to know whether he has that same mentality. So I could see someone that we completely would not expect win the French this year, just because of the Rafa not being there effect. Who handles that mentally better than anyone else? I think Medvedev in Rome just pretty much took advantage of the opportunity that was before him. I mean, you'll never hear guys say this, but the way the weather was that week and the schedule, I mean, I think some guys just said, I'm out of here. And so, you know, hats off to Medvedev for taking advantage of that and winning, because it was certainly a surprise.
What's your take on where Novak is now?
Big question mark. I mean, you know, I've always said that the intangible with Novak is what's up here. I mean, his game has no weaknesses. There's nothing you can pick on. There's nothing that you can look at and say, I'm going to do this to Novak today and win. It's just a matter of what sort of frame of mind he's in and the belief he has coming into the French. Now, he would be the heir apparent. You feel like if Rafa's not there, the only other guy that's kind of been in on that same level, if not even higher, is Novak. So I think he's the favorite. You have to go with him as the favorite, but I don't know what sort of headspace he's in now with the way things have gone for him so far in the clay season.
Yeah, to me, I think the headspace will be solid, you know, as always with Novak, provided the body is. I think that's, to me, you know, he had the elbow issue early in the clay court season. It looked like he was better in Rome. He had a couple of wins that he needed. To me, he got what he needed out of Rome. He kind of, I'm not going to say he didn't throw in the towel against Runa, but he wasn't willing to pay the price physically, which of course he's able to do when he wants to, particularly in the major. So I don't know if that was just, like you said, like maybe he's like, I'm out of here, I got what I needed, or was it, you know, the elbow's not quite right? That to me will tell us a lot about where his mental headspace is, because I don't think there's any doubt that if he's physically feeling good, he's going to be ready to go the distance and go to the wall to get number 23. All right, on the women's side, Swiatek, even though with a loss to Rybakina and she pulled out. You know, the issue with the injury could be a factor, but assuming she's healthy, I still put her as a favorite in the normal conditions of clay court tennis. Rybakina, however we want to say it, you know, has played great this year. So has Sabalenka. Those three have seemed to really distance themselves from the pack in the women's game. Do you have a preference for either one of those three, or is there someone else lurking outside there that you think could make a run there as well?
I think there's always someone lurking at the French. That seems to be the one where we have players just kind of burst out of nowhere and make deep runs. But I think the odds are it's Swiatek, like you said. I'd love to see, you know, somebody like a Jessie Pegula catch fire at the French and come away with her first major. I think that the French, there's just so many variables with the way the weather is and
right.
The way the schedule goes. It's hard to be the favorite at the French unless you're Rafa. So I always sit back when the French starts and just watch how it unfolds because it's
the expect the unexpected.
It's the
basically.
Most difficult one to predict.
All right, just to wrap things up, Sam, and I appreciate you giving me as much of your time, especially after working diligently as you did covering the NCAAs. What was the overall vibe? I mean, I read the New York Times article. I watched some of it on the Crack Racket stream, which was fun, the semifinals. Those guys are on top of it, obviously know their college tennis. You did the men's final with Mark Bay, our good buddy from Chicago, right?
Well, we attempted to. It was a stream.
You attempted
to. I did the women's final on Tennis Channel with CeCe Bellis.
With CeCe. Okay, how's she doing, by the way?
She's great. Doing great. Married and doing wonderfully.
Awesome.
But the men's final was supposed to happen after the women's final on Tennis Channel, but because of the rain, they pushed it back a day. That lost their linear television coverage. And so we tried to, the NCAA streamed it, asked me because I live here to come over and call
right.
with Mark, but the entire scoring system went down early Uh-oh. In that match. So there was
right.
about 40.
That's impossible. We didn't That's know chaos.
The, fortunately, it right. was during the first set of singles. So we were able to recover and show who won the title, but
right.
you know, it was interesting.
It was a production disaster yeah. is what you're telling me.
Yeah. Pretty much.
You know, people don't realize because, you know, I've covered some, I was in Georgia with you.
Yeah.
Remember years ago with you and Jimmy Arias, we covered some college tennis. I actually covered the ACC tournament years ago when ESPN3 was sort of dipping into it. I loved it. I mean, yeah. it was so much fun. But when I sat there and, you know, because my mind's like you, like I'm following every match, even when I'm commentating. So I'm like, we got to go to four. You know, no, it's break point. It's a deciding point. Of it. Let's go over it. But to actually make that happen when you're in the production truck, when you're actually producing it and directing it. Okay, that's the guy who's calling out the cameras, the director and the producer saying we got to go here. I mean, it's unbelievably complicated. And especially when you're... And for the most part, let's be honest, when you cover college tennis, you're doing it on a limited budget. So to me, it's actually makes it even harder because to do it right, you need even more firepower than you have at like the biggest pro tournaments because you've got to basically cover six courts at the exact same time. You've got to know the score on every court. You got to check the score so someone's following it. You know what I'm saying? Like they got to put up the graphics. I mean, it's very complicated. So I could see how things could go awry, which obviously they did during the men's final.
Yeah, I mean it. You know, and that was more of a technological issue at the facility than it was a production issue. But
okay.
you know, producing college tennis, we have the same situation with beach volleyball where we produce that. We do that at ESPN where you've got five courts going at the same time. So there's an art to it. And basically, you just have to make sure that you are on the court where the critical thing is happening, whether that
right.
is the end of a set or whether it is a end of a match. And then, of course, the clinching point. So whoever is producing that show really has to be on top of what's happening on all six courts and is collaborating with us in the booth to know where to go. So when I'm calling a college tennis match, I may be calling Schneider and Brantmeyer on one, but I've
right.
got my eye on four And CC, yep. for example, who's the analyst, she'll be tapping me on the shoulder and pointing at three, mm-hmm. like, hey, we need to go here.
And then, right. and then you need people like that that absolutely know exactly what we know as tennis aficionados in the production team. And that's not easy to find.
No.
You know what I'm saying? Like people, and it's one thing to cover tennis, like a cover an ATP event, but to cover college tennis is a totally different thing. And I think it's, I still think, I mean, and I've seen many people, you know, write to me and say to me that, you know, college tennis is the best kept secret, right? In yeah. tennis in general. It's such a great event to watch with the energy, with the heckling. There's way too much cheating, but I'll leave that for another time, but not in the NCAA tournament because they can't. But that drives me crazy about college tennis. I just got to put that out there. But there's an opportunity there. It's just a question of we need the resources to take advantage of that opportunity. And that, to me, has always been the $64,000 question. Like, how do we get enough resources to make it worthwhile that that whether it's an ESPN or whomever, Tennis Channel, is going to say, yeah, we want to do it right because we actually think we can sell this.
Well, college tennis is unlike just about every other sport because every single match is going to give you a very exciting moment at the end because it's never over until that final point on one court and you don't know what court that's going to be. The problem with college tennis and television from a broadcast standpoint is it's really hard to fit college tennis into a 2-hour window or even a 2.5-hour window.
Right. Good point.
One yeah. of the ideas without changing the rules, because by the way, they play no ad scoring, which I absolutely yep. love. If you're serving and you're down love 30, holy crap, you're in trouble right now because
right.
if you get back up to deuce, it's still break point. It's deciding point. So there's drama on every court, but if you just started college tennis with singles and you said, hey, mm-hmm. TV network, we're playing 6 matches of singles, and if it's right. 3-all at the end of singles, then we're deciding the whole thing with the doubles.
One doubles. Or you could even just play one doubles, like 10-point break.
Yeah, if you want to keep the 3 out there and play the 1-set match, is great. Right. But what happens?
But the purists don't like that. I even have people come up to me now that are pissed off that it's not 2 out of 3 singles. And, you know, when I played at Stanford, it was 6 singles, then 3 doubles, full matches.
And I think Division III still does that. But
yeah.
But if you want to be a product on television, viewers now have a shorter attention span. Tennis is thrilling when you're there in person. That atmosphere for NC State and North Carolina, I mean, I'm from the state. It was like going to a Carolina State basketball game. It was incredible.
Wow.
But if you start with the singles, then the match, if it's not over, all of a sudden the doubles is just unbelievably exciting because right now everybody's so amped up for the doubles. It's that New York Times article encapsulates it really well. It's a lot of high energy. Doubles is over. And now there's this lull where you start
right.
singles and you're just
plodding yeah.
through the first sets. And then it picks up again at the end, but that could be 3 hours away. So it
Good
would
point.
Make more sense
yeah.
to try to, you know, I think speed.
I always liked the fact that our matches when I was in college could, you know, that the final match when it was even, like now you get 3-all and it comes down to one of the singles matches.
Yeah.
I always thought coming down to a doubles match was amazing.
Yeah.
Because it brought the team, you know, 4 guys on the court or girls. And, you know, just like it happens in the singles, both teams gather around it. But something about the doubles, to me, that's more the message of college tennis, right? That it's that you're really playing for your team. And I like the fact that the clinching point, for the most part, you know, you could sweep them in singles, obviously, but in most of the big matches, you'd go in, you know, 3-all or 4-2 into the doubles. And to me, those were by far the most exciting memories I have of college tennis was being out there in the final doubles match
yeah.
to win the match for your team or lose it.
Well, it's really the only way that I can think of without changing the rules, because the only way to do it without changing rules is to just change the structure. And I think television would be more interested in covering it, because then you have a legitimate shot to finish 6 singles matches within 2 hours,
right.
especially with no ad scoring. And then if you do have to go to doubles, it's exciting. TV wants to stay for that because it's a dramatic
right.
moment and your audience grows.
Sam, it's been awesome to have you. We went way over that we were supposed to, because this has been so enlightening for me, entertaining for everyone listening, I'm sure. Enjoy a little. I hope you. What's next for you? You got any college stuff? I know you got a little downtime before Wimbledon.
Actually, NCAA tennis and or NCAA softball always ends my season.
Okay.
So I'm off now until we head to Wimbledon. So
awesome.
Be enjoying.
Well, enjoy. Thanks for coming on Holding Court, and I will see you on the other side for the All England Club.
Okay, buddy.
You got it. Sam Gore, everyone, on Holding Court. Don't forget to subscribe to and share Holding Court.
Holding Court is powered by Mudhouse Media.